All right, good evening, everybody.
Hi.
How are you? Very excited for tonight. We've been planning this for a while. Some members of the reading groups tonight have been coming to the open mic. The first Monday of every month, we have an open mic here at the Writer Center, and it's one of my favorite evenings that we run, partly because of the breadth of voice, but also because of the quality. The stories that we've been hearing have been so good that I finally thought we should devote a whole night to these people, and I know there are more because Joe told me there were the writing groups. So I'm very excited to have members of these Rockport writing groups here reading, and I invite you also to continue to come and read here. We love to hear your voices, and I'm looking forward to your reading. I'll put the mic down here. The mic is for recording purposes, so you'll have to use your good oratory voice. And without further ado, our first reader tonight is Judy Spur.
So should I put that up?
Are you going to stand or
sit? It would be nice. I know the most people will read stories, and I was part of the flash fiction group briefly, but what I'm going to do is some flash poetry with a sonnet mixed in. Side by side. Side by side we lie sleepless, images seared on closed eyelids of blazing towers pierced by twin arrows, number 11 and number 175. That's the World Trade Center. And this is a sonnet, and I wrote it at the time that the Supreme Court was deciding about gay marriage. And it sounds very Shakespearean, if you'll excuse me. The right to matter. When bigotry and hatred pierce the hearts of men and women cursed by malice cold, with pained exclusion hurled by bloody darts, dripping with intemperate taunts of old, do we in conscience argue for their rights as God's creations blessed by human love, though cursed and wounded cruelly by slights? Seek worldly justice, sanctioned from above. Oh, that humanity would justice seek, arise from complicit apathy, grasp, forsway a craven inaction of the meek, and cast away rank prejudice at last. Then we and they could hand in hand rejoice of humankind's redemption with one voice. Sea smoke. Lacy sea smoke swirls across the ebony ocean. Ghostly tendrils dance across the waves, embrace a lone lobster boat held in winter's icy grip, whirl away in silent ballet like a chorus line, racing with the wind against time. Spring sun smokes the tundra. This is called half notes. Spring sun smokes the tundra, sends torrents of tumbling water, pushing silted riverbanks in its path, singing lustily, rippling half notes smother birdsong. Deer, elk, coyote seek nourishment in turgid pools. I wrote this in Walnut Creek, sitting on a riverbank in Walnut Creek in Sedona. The summer house. Is it lonely by the sea without us? With winter winds beating at your sides, do you wait patiently for our return to mend your winter wounds? Does the sound of life and laughter make you sigh their home? That was about a house at Long Beach. My mother's hands sit in my lap, spotted and wrinkled. A soft patina stretches across knuckles, swollen into knobs, wrapping at age. I have my mother's hands. Now this one you'll have to forgive me for. She wears black, all black from head to toe. Under a black feathered hat, her milk white face gleams, mirrors the silky black satin dress, whispering as she sways across the room. All eyes turn toward her. Who is this striking vision in black? She stops above me. I don't look up. I can smell her breath, black with the smell of whiskey, black as her cold heart. The room is silent, waiting. She leans forward over the table. Her black hair falls across her face. brushes my cheek, her white face falls into the soup.
This is called The Counter Girl at Brown's. I'm the counter girl. I'm here at the lunch counter all summer and on weekends throughout the winter so I can pay my tuition and buy my gas to commute down to Salem to school. I like working here at the coffee shop in the basement of Brown's department store. I hate that it's a basement and I never see the light of day, but that's really my only complaint. I like my boss. He's a little wiry Greek guy named George who drives here every day from Woburn while it's still dark. He brings a box of pastries, always the same selection, including coffee rolls, donuts, and raspberry turnovers. For most of the day, a cigarette hangs from the corner of his mouth while he mans the grill or mixes up the ham salad in the back. He makes the huge vats of coffee as soon as he arrives, and it gets served all day, no matter that it tastes like burnt toast after 10:30. He works hard. I work hard, too. And he gives me a raise the first day, from $1.80 to $1.85 an hour. Before long, I get to know the regulars, people who work in the departments up above us and meander down to sit on the stools and drink coffee on their breaks, and people from nearby businesses who come in for lunch or pie and coffee in the afternoon. Most of them chat us up, teasing and bantering back and forth with George and each other, except for the two brothers who own the store. Ramrod straight in their business suits, they sit aloof, sipping their coffees, black and stale. Some of the regulars I like, some I don't. And there are some that George absolutely cannot stand, like Marguerite, a hefty chatterbox who lifts the sugar dispenser and, while she's talking, often to no one in particular, she begins to pour the sugar about 8 inches before it reaches her coffee cup. Every day, a trail of sugar on the counter and a trail of verbiage from her mouth. It drives George nuts. Mostly she orders just coffee and makes her mess. But once in a while she gets a hot dog with mustard and onion, which at least prevents her from talking too much. George wishes she would order more food instead of taking up a seat for just a cup of coffee, the cup left drained with hot pink lipstick on the rim. At the likable end of the spectrum of customers is Mr. Klein. George always addresses him that way. A local attorney, impeccably dressed and groomed, with the remnants of his snow-white hair coiffed neatly around his ears. He is perpetually preoccupied, probably with great judicial matters. So much so that sometimes he forgets to pay. And one time, he even scooped up someone else's change, thinking it was his. But George forgives him, because he hardly ever chats and he never spills any sugar. It can get pretty boring working the counter, with the regulars and their regular orders and the same menu day after day. George tries to get creative once in a while. When we land on the moon, he creates the moon burger. Just a regular hamburger with some added topping. Maybe it's bacon. The moon burger is so successful, it leads to the Mars burger. I forget what's on that one. But it's a positive time. People are excited about our country's achievement. And there's levity and even more bantering than usual from both the stools and from behind the counter. I have a little tip cup. People leave quarters, dimes, and nickels, even pennies. Marguerite never leaves anything. If George gets a tip, he puts it in my cup. Surprisingly, the tips add up, and often I spend my half-hour lunch browsing the housewares department and purchasing treasures for my hope chest. I'm getting married this fall. George and his wife are invited. It's a happy time for me. I'm more excited about the wedding than the moon landing. I still don't know what I don't know. I don't know that the marriage won't last. I don't know the names or faces of the children I will bear. I don't have any idea about the catastrophes I'll create for myself, the depths of despair I'll experience, the songs I'll sing, or the accomplishments I'll own. Oblivious to the future, I pour the coffees, make the sandwiches, and cut the pie, and wipe up the sugar trail that Marguerite left on the counter today.
Thank you.
Next is Cindy Sharfstein.
Fine. Snow Day. Growing up in Hannibal, New York, snowstorms and lake effect were phrases that were part of our local weatherman's forecast nearly every night during the months of February and March. Using radar forecasts wasn't part of the nightly news during the late 1950s and the early 60s. Since our community was located south of Lake Ontario and east of the cities of Rochester and Buffalo, much of the forecasts included what had happened earlier that day in those cities, because they were also part of the snow belt. As a youngster, I was most excited if an impending blizzard might occur on a school day. Nothing was more thrilling to my 10-year-old self than coming downstairs in the morning to be greeted by my mother with her smile and these words, "No school today, Cindy. They just announced that Hannibal is closed." When you're 10 years old, that does not mean that you go back upstairs and climb into bed. And in 1959, there were no electronic devices to capture my attention. What usually transpired was a quick breakfast of something hot and nourishing, like oatmeal or cream of wheat, followed by an hour or so of watching Captain Kangaroo, and then the Magic Toy Shop, a local show. Then I would hurry upstairs and get dressed as quickly as I could manage. Our house was never very warm. My father was a proponent of keeping things cool, with the explanation that an extra wool sweater and a pair of good socks would keep you comfortable. Also, heating a rambling old country farmhouse cost a lot of money, so we always turned the thermostat way down at night. That meant that it took a while to warm up in the morning. So I have vivid memories of standing over the register in the dining room to catch the rush of warm air that our furnace was generating. What to do from that point on totally depended on the conditions outside our kitchen windows. If the winds were still howling and the snow was still blowing and drifting, my day would likely be spent inside. But on the days where the sun came out once the snowfall ceased, there was truly a winter wonderland awaiting. Breaking off icicles that had formed on the eaves was always great fun. No one had ever told us that snow or icicles contained anything that might be unsafe to eat. Building snow caves was fun, and something that I could do alone, which was usually my situation on a snow day. My nearest friend lived almost a mile away, so we rarely got together when the weather was bad. If we did, there would be games of fox and geese, sledding on our hill, and lots of cups of hot cocoa. I do remember one afternoon when I was all alone and I decided to wade through the snow in the field behind our house. And my tall, green rubber boots became so firmly stuck in the snow and the ice that I was unable to pull them free. No one could hear my cries for help, and I had to maneuver my feet out of the boots and then make my way back to the house in my wool stocking feet. I wonder, whatever happened to those boots?
Thank
Jean Keith.
So first a poem, Sea Stones at Cape Hedge. Jagged rock chunks heaved up from deep sleep by ancient glacial scraping, advance and retreat. Now pebbles, smoothed round, oval, oblong, by eons of relentless, rhythmic, ineluctable, sea swell and sea crash of the moon-ruled tides. Brindled rust, mottled gray, fired amber, polished black, pearlescent white, striated, swirled, speckled. Tossed and tumbled in the seafoam and salt spray, merrily shushing, angrily rumbling, under sea rise and sea fall eternal. Seated on the shore's sand slope, watching, listening, breathing in this dazzling dance, I can do nothing, speak no words, just be. And this is a memoir with some name changes. The neighbors. We lived next door to the Rubens until I was 10. They were the only Jewish family at our end of the street on Bellevue Hill in a suburb just west of Boston. Other Jewish families lived closer to its summit. The Blumenthals, who owned the Waleko Candy Company, a great spot to trick-or-treat, an MIT physicist who my father explained invented the gyroscope, and an assortment of doctors and lawyers. Their expansive homes had circular or gated driveways, columned fronts, and even some topiary shrubs. Our block was a mix of modest older colonials, a few weathered Victorians, and some two-family houses. The Rubens owned one of the latter, a nondescript gray stucco box with neatly trimmed bushes and lawn. They rented the upstairs to other Jewish families. Irving Rubin was an ambitious professional photographer, always dressed rather formally in a crisp white shirt, tie and jacket, and carrying his cumbersome camera and lighting equipment to and from the family sedan each weekday. He was pleasant, soft-spoken, smiling. I liked him very much, even naming my baby doll after him, Baby Irving. He was a busy portrait photographer, beginning to make a name for himself, often shooting dignitaries in Boston, politicians, businessmen, and religious figures. My Irish Catholic mother cherished a small sepia-toned image of then Archbishop of Boston Richard J. Cushing, which Irving had presented to her. She kept it on her nightstand for the rest of her life. Irving's slender, dark-haired wife, Rachel, was high-strung, seemingly always scrubbing the kitchen, washing and hanging laundry, and anxiously looking after their two young children, Hannah and Michael. For some reason, she often let me hang around with her, which I especially liked when she was cooking. Because her in-laws were Orthodox Jews, Rachel needed to keep a kosher kitchen. All that meant to me then was that it had to be immaculately clean and no pork could be cooked or eaten at the Rubens. Back in the late 50s, the hazards of consuming animal fats and cured meats were unheard of. Common wisdom was that children should start their day with a hot breakfast of eggs and bacon, buttered toast, and orange juice, regularly dosed with loathsome cod liver oil. Apparently, Rachel subscribed to this belief too, but feared that if her in-laws ever happened to drop by and detected the aroma of bacon cooking, they'd disown her. She had a plan, however. Particularly on cold, wintry mornings, after Irving headed out to work, she would send her two little ones to our house and arrange with my mother to feed them said hot breakfast with my younger brother and me. The meal was often topped off with hot cocoa and marshmallow, which resulted in the double transgression of combining meat with dairy. In return for this favor, Rachel made us blintzes. In the six decades that have passed since I tasted Rachel's blintzes, I've never eaten any more delectable. Golden and lightly crispy on the outside, filled with tangy, creamy ricotta cheese inside. I would watch her working at her counter and stove,
deep concentration in her dark eyes as she carefully mixed, filled, fried, and drained the delicate rolls in brown paper bags. She gave me small helper tasks. She was in her element. Irving and Rachel were somewhere in their 20s then, and my parents were a good 10 years older. The two couples, although friendly as neighbors, didn't socialize together and maintained a degree of reserve that I sensed. But despite their age, religious, and cultural differences, their mutual respect and kindness expressed their bond. Thank you.
Once again, thank you all for coming. I think this is terrific. And thank you, Amanda. Thank you, the Gloucester Writer Center. This story is a new one, and it's called All About Eve. After the movie, they walked to Huntley's for ice cream. Not far, but on the other side of town, and it was nearer to her house. He paid for the tickets and ice cream for the two of them, though she had said quite a few times she thought they should go Dutch. They both ordered sundaes. This was Saturday, the day after he had the fight with his father, pushing one another back and forth like boys on a vacant lot, banging their heads up against the walls and then falling against the door and into the bathroom and onto the cold tile floor. His mother watched them and told them to stop, cried for them to stop. Nobody bled, and nobody talked about it afterwards. In the theater, his arm fell asleep against the hard metallic back of her seat, and he had to move it slowly, and she seemed not to notice at all. At home, in just a few months from then, his mother would take his father's double-edged razor blade and in her shaking fingers try to strike it across her wrist, hoping to make her big getaway. And he would find her and force the razor from her hand, and the ambulance would come and take her to the hospital with the sirens blaring. The girl's name was Karen. She was in his English class, Mrs. Larrabee. Mrs. Larrabee talked a lot about Jesus in class and Mary Magdalene, as if everyone knew who that was. And he thought maybe it was Jesus's mother. She was talking about. He figured Karen must know for sure because she had a gold cross she wore draped over the top button of her blouse. After the movies, they sat in a booth at Huntley's, talking until the ice cream came about the movie and the actors. And she said that sometimes after a movie, she feels weird, like she's been changed somehow, as if she's become one of the actresses. Like in the movie they just saw where Anne Baxter plays this woman named Eve Harrington. And then when they left the theater, out on the sidewalk, it was like she had become Eve, walking like her, holding her head like she did, sounding a little like her, doing what she might do. He told her sometimes he feels the same way. They talked easily, as if he hadn't touched her breast, his hand on her pale blue cotton blouse while they were watching the movie. She hadn't moved at all when he did that. He'd felt the cotton slide smoothly over the firm curve of her bra. They both had just stared straight ahead at the screen from their seats way in the back row of the theater. He liked watching the way she put her fists on her hips with the other cheerleaders, leaning forward and shouting out the "I can't hear you" cheer, imploring the crowd to yell louder. And they would shout it out again and again and again, and each time louder, until all at once they'd clap and leap up with their heads back, their faces turned to one side, their hips forward and their legs kicking up behind them, their wide pleated white wool skirts flaring out, and the pom-poms in their hands shaking in front of their thick sweaters with their breasts pushing forward. And sitting across from her, when the ice cream came and she began to spoon it to her lips, he thought, looking at her, her eyes brown with kindness, about how he had felt and how she might have felt when he had touched her for that brief moment. How he felt so warm and thrilled and scared. And then he wondered if she felt the same way and why she hadn't moved at all, not even to take his hand away or to move closer or to turn toward him or away from him or anything at all. And what had he expected anyway? That she would hold his hand or put her arms around him and he would feel the softness of her against him and he'd smell her skin and her hair and that would comfort him and he would feel so good about her and about touching her and that he would feel okay about himself? He wanted to feel okay about himself. When they finished the ice cream, he left a quarter on the table. And he walked her home, past the post office and the library. It was still light out and warm. He had $2.50 left in his pocket, and he rubbed the coins together between his fingers and thought about her while he walked back to his house along the old post road where the high school was and where the boys were there smoking on the steps.
A few months ago, our president said that he wanted to have a parade, and I reacted rather angrily to that thought that he would spend $25 million on that parade. And I've read this before, but I thought I'd read it again. And it was ironic because I read in the paper today that he's talking about it again. So it seemed apropos. So the story is, here's your damn parade, Mr. President. Bill looked forward to his small-town Memorial Day parade. He brought a fold-up chair and a pint of Jameson's Irish whiskey to keep himself calm. He never drank much before the IED in Iraq went off, leaving him alive in a swirl of ringing ears, unbearable headaches, and diminished motor skills. Now he drank from dawn till dusk, trying to suppress his churning depression and crushing head pain. In addition to his chair, he carried a loaded 9mm pistol in his belt. Bill set up his chair at the entrance to the cemetery so he would not miss the pretty little girls in white dresses who carried lilacs to place on the graves of fallen soldiers, some of whom were his buddies from Iraq and Afghanistan. Seeing the little girls always made him cry and somehow relieved some of the pressure on his head. Bill arrived about 20 minutes early and sat sipping his whiskey as he waited. But this time he fell asleep. He dreamed about a parade, an alternate parade to the heroic one being planned by the president. Bill's fantasy parade was led by a smiling, gold-toothed, 7-foot skeleton in sparkling red, white, and blue attire, walking on running blades and holding a baton with a gilded skull at its top. The maudlin thump of muffled tom-tom drums in the back of the parade sounded out a dreary cadence to the marchers. Right behind the colorful but grotesque drum major was a regiment of veterans, they too on running blades. They were wrapped in ragged field-green capes, and some wore badly scarred battle helmets. They spun round and round like whirling dervishes. Their open capes revealed any number of mangled and disfigured bodies as they spun frenetically as if trying to escape their wounds. Next was a wheelchair brigade. Some of the men were strapped in like zombies, their movement dependent on the ability to move a finger or two. Signs tied to the wheelchairs proclaimed, "Get out of Iraq and Afghanistan." Some expressed their anger by shaking their outstretched fists defiantly as spectators carrying placards with the president's picture. The whir of their wheels and the clicks and clangs of their frequent bumps and crashes seemed to fixate the onlookers, many of whom could be seen wiping tears from their eyes. The monotony of the drums persisted, filling the air with a heightening sense of despair. A platoon of the tortured came next, all wearing Guantanamo Bay T-shirts. One man carried a waterboarding bench, and a few others carried gallon jugs of water. They stopped periodically to demonstrate to the viewers how waterboarding worked and how closely it simulated actual drowning. There were loudspeakers with the sounds of crying babies, said to make the torture worse. Huge gasps could be heard from the crowd as people were horrified by what they saw. A battalion of gun rights proponents followed, carrying Protect the Second Amendment banners. A box truck advertising discounted AR-15s was led by men wrapped in cartridge belts, carrying dozens of guns and boxes of ammunition. Behind the truck were the complicit murderers of Congress and members of the NRA, with blood dripping from their hands, blood money in their bulging pockets, but waving nevertheless amidst a cacophony of boos. Behind them there was a large flatbed truck with the bullet-riddled bodies of murdered children, propped up in chairs with signs designating the schools they had attended. Next came the largest entry in the parade, an army of mutilated and emaciated children. Naked and cold from all over the world, their small, broken, and ravaged bodies told the story of unjust wars and unimaginable cruelty. Bloated bellies and wasted muscles revealed starvation, sometimes due simply to blocked access to nearby food supplies. Many died along the way. Lastly came a division of giant rats, wearing sanitation workers' hats and white smocks, carrying brooms, dustpans, and pitchforks, and gathering the remains of those that fell dead along the way. They fed voraciously on the afflicted and the misery, and some carried huge signs that said, "Make America Great Again." Bill woke up startled by the gun salute in the cemetery for the fallen that ended each year's parade and ceremonies. Dazed and disappointed that he had missed the little girls in white dresses putting lilacs on the soldiers' graves, he took another pull on the Jamesons, picked up his chair, and moved across the street in front of a mausoleum, apparently to watch the people leave in the cemetery. He sat down and pulled out his 9mm and shot himself to death.
Next is Connie Comack. This is a little different because this is the very first few pages of a novel that I'm working on. The novel is about a woman named Maggie, and her full name is Mary Margaret McMurdy Greenstein. But you're going to meet Mary Margaret as an 8-year-old, and this is how the novel starts. "Oh, but you are a willful, spoiled child, Miss Mary Margaret McMurdy," barked Sister Catherine as she approached Maggie, slapping a ruler in the palm of her hand. "Put out your hands." Maggie looked up and locked eyes with the angry nun walking towards her. As Maggie gazed calmly at her teacher, hands still in her lap, she deftly slipped the passed note under the waistband of her plaid skirt. "What is in your hand, Mary Margaret?"
"Nothing, sister."
"You're lying."
"I am not."
"Then show me your hands." Maggie slowly drew her hands from her lap, slid them
gently closed with fingers down across the desktop, rested them there, all the while looking directly into the bloodshot eyes of Sister Catherine. "Open your hands now!" shouted the infuriated nun. Maggie slowly turned over her hands and uncurled them. Now empty, still looking directly but calmly at Sister Catherine. Now that the note was safely tucked away, Maggie wanted to show respect to the sister. She felt neither fear nor defiance. She was ready for what was coming. It had happened before, to her and to others. Down came the ruler, thwack, across the palms of her hand. "Ow!" screamed Maggie, despite her inner resolve not to react. The ruler had landed with more force than usual. "You naughty, willful brat!" yelled the nun, now in a frenzy, as she brought the ruler down twice more on Maggie's opened hands. The last time, the flat side of the ruler was not the surface that landed on Maggie's hand. The metal edge landed with such force that it drew blood along the padded edge near the fingers of Maggie's left hand. Maggie watched with horror as the first red drop appeared on her hand and grew to a rivulet of blood flowing into her palm. "Look, she's bleeding!" shouted one of the nearby girls. Other girls in the class began shouting or crying. Sister Catherine stared at Maggie's bleeding hand and began backing away towards her desk. As she did so, Maggie slipped out of her chair and ran for the classroom door at the back, heading for the bathroom. But when she opened the door, she ran into Mother Superior, who had been drawn to the classroom by the noise. The Reverend Mother, who was also the school principal, was about to scold her when she noticed Maggie's bloody hand. "What happened, child?" she asked gently. Maggie looked up at the Mother Superior, tears spilling from her large blue-green eyes, and shrugged her shoulders. The Reverend Mother raised her head from Maggie and looked through the open door, taking in the scene before her. "Run along to the dispensary, Mary Margaret, and have your hand looked after. I will be along in a minute." 5 minutes later, the Mother Superior entered the dispensary, noticed Maggie's bandaged hand, and asked the nurse, "How is she, Sister Claire?" "Ah, she's doing fine, aren't you, me darling?" Sister Claire replied, addressing Maggie. Maggie nodded, but said nothing. "She's got a pretty deep cut on her hand," Sister Claire continued, addressing the Mother Superior. "Could use a stitch or two. I can't do that here. She'd need to see her doctor. And he should check to see that her tetanus shots are up to date. I understand her hand was cut by something with a metal edge. She won't say what." "Thank you, sister," said the Reverend Mother. "I'll take it from here." Then turning to Maggie, she continued, "Come along, Mary Margaret. We'll call your mother and ask her to pick you up." That's it.
Hello.
Hello.
And I'm pleased to share my first children's book, and which I just published. And this was written just to share both with other parents and also my own children a joyful time in our lives when they were 6 and 4. And it's told in the voice of my oldest son, Jeremy, who was 6 at the time. And it's called Moonwalk. In the middle of the book, there's a few pages with no text, so I'll just show you a few of those illustrations. Kyle and I were building a fort with blankets and chairs in the living room when Mommy ran in and said, "It's almost time." We looked out the window. It was dark outside, but we could see the shapes of the trees swaying against a silvery sky. We rushed to put our shoes on. I could tell Mommy was excited. Are you ready for an adventure, Jeremy and Kyle? Yes. We walked out the door and saw the lake just beyond the trees. It was shimmering with light. An owl called, hoo, 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 as we walked down the porch steps toward the path through the woods. My blanket, shouted Kyle as he turned around to run back inside. I went back, too, to get Henry. He likes the fresh air. Mommy said she needed her sandals. We started out again, this time with Kyle's blanket, my dog Henry, and Mommy's sandals. When we walked through the woods, dry sticks snapped under our shoes. The path turned, and we walked onto the beach at the edge of the lake. We took off our shoes and felt the sand between our toes. We found an old bench and sat down together. Mom, Kyle in his blanket, my dog Henry, and me. We sat quietly, looked at the moon, and felt the moonlight. Let's cuddle together. This is our special time, whispered Mom. We listened to the night sounds. After a while, we walked back home. We changed into our pajamas, climbed into our comfy beds, and fell asleep, dreaming of our moonwalk. When will you plan your family moonwalk? Look for clear skies.
Next is Holly Herring.
Hello.
Hi.
A while back, Joe offered a cover of a New Yorker as a prompt for our writing group. And this is it. This cover shows a family camping with two girls playing in the stream, a mother reading with a glass of wine, and a father desperately spraying the sidelines with insecticide. A tent is partially visible, and I wondered if a 13-year-old boy was in there. These are his words. You don't see me because I'm in the tent with my Game Boy. Sure, the game is old and simplistic, but it shuts me off from the rest of them. So annoying they are. The girls so girly with their water play. I hope the crayfish nibble their toes. The only thing worth doing would to be playing a little soccer, but Packer would have been the only one willing to join me. His front teeth slightly gumming the ball so it wouldn't puncture, a trick he finally learned. But no, dogs aren't allowed in the state park. If Dad wasn't so freaked out by the ticks, he might have been fun for a walk. But I'm done with all of them. Eighth grade starts next week, and that just sucks. I've almost gotten to the next level with the game. If only I could knock off the serpent and get through the gate. Such a little movement of my thumbs, and a whole new world opens up to me. I'm in control. The world conforms to my manipulation. Why can't it be like that at school? Mom's gonna peek in on me soon. I can tell, because she put her wine glass in the chair holder and she's stretching out her legs towards her flip-flops. The shadows are moving towards my tent. Please don't bother me. Don't ask me those annoying questions. Packer would get it. He'd be my pillow. I could nestle with him and he'd only lick me. But Mom, she wants me to come out, put on a hat, give time to my sisters and play again, like last year. I wish I was back at camp, where they would have already confiscated my Game Boy, and where at our evening cabin check-in, the boys who I thought were solid, refined, and confident would sometimes cry. It was like those little tatters of the undercarpet would peel up. They talk about older siblings in trouble, parents fighting, and their fears. Eric even mentioned the alcohol that felt like it poured through the roof of his family, ran outside of the pipes, pooled in the crevices of the basement, and absorbed in the sponges. I didn't speak up because I didn't know if Mom's wine was a problem yet. It felt more imminent, like a dark cloud ahead, when you aren't sure if the wind is heading your way. I keep glancing at the AA brochures at the library and wonder how many boxes need to be checked. My summer camp list was easy to check off. Bathing suit, sunscreen, towel, board games to share. But Mom's drinking, it's too confusing. Each day, I try to gauge the weight of the wine box in the cabinet to see how much she has drunk. Is a bottle of wine when friends are over too much? I was watching. She was the only one who drank white, and yet she opened a new bottle. Whoops, clumsy me, she said after she broke the glass. Her slurred speech was humiliating. I wanted to melt into the closet with the smelly wet broom that had glass shards entangled in the bristles. Packer had tried to lip up the spill, and a small sliver lodged in his tongue. The red blood mixed with the white wine made a marbled effect on the linoleum floor. I was the only one he stayed still for, as I gently extracted it. She didn't even apologize the next morning. I saw her go jogging with her friend Nancy, and I wish she would puke. Get it out, all of it. Get out the need to fill herself. Why aren't we enough? Why isn't Dad aware? And the girls, they just giggle and splash in the water. Oh, wait, I figured it out. Eric told me I could tunnel under the armory and enter the keep from the side. It worked. I'm in the wizard's realm now. Okay, Mom, I'm coming. Just give me a minute, please.
Next is Joe Muzio.
All of us are writers, and things have to be put into perspective. I thank again Annie and Henry, who about 5 years ago gave me the opportunity to read from a memoir that I had written about my immigrant parents. My dad had only a sixth grade education and was on the streets of New York thereafter, apprenticed to a blacksmith. My mother never graduated from high school, and despite those educational limitations, they were two of the most loving people I've ever known, highly competent, and sent me to Columbia. That unleashed on a society a lot of trouble. That's still going on. Since that night with Annie and Henry and a large group of people that came to the Rocky Neck Center that I mentioned on Saturday, I have since written more than 50 personal essays that are on a website. And because most of this book, Buddy Remembers Then and Now, is about my parents, family members and others have asked me to continue the saga of our family that moved to Rockport about 10 years ago, and that's underway. I'll read two portions from this. One is about my mother and her sister. My grandmother was a superintendent on Baxter Street in New York City and was in charge of a five-story tenement. I was taken recently by Baxter Street because I found out that Mr. Manafort, someone you may have heard about through the Trump organization, owns property there and has been buying up Baxter Street for whatever his motives. Philomena had a totally different experience. She frequently told us that she and her younger sister Lucille had to scrub five stories worth of marble tile floors and stairs and clean the building's brass handrails every Saturday night, usually later at night. Then, early every Sunday morning, the building's owner came by to check their work, scrutinizing what they'd done as thoroughly and compulsively as any United States Marine Corps drill instructor would inspect his platoon of recruits before granting liberty. If he wasn't satisfied, the children had to change out of their clean church clothes and redo the unsatisfactory jobs. Only when he was completely satisfied could the family now go to Mass at Transfiguration Church on Mott Street, often having to go to a later Mass as a result. Just like the Marine Corps, there were no excuses for their supposed or real poor performance. Corrections had to be made. I once asked my mother why she and Aunt Lucille had to work so late on Saturday nights. I thought it might have been because it reduced the chance someone dirtying the floors before the next morning's inspection. She told me that was part of the reason, but there was another one. Her mother wanted this. Typically, the men who lived in the building were back in their apartments by 9:30 p.m. This made it safe for the young girls to do their chores without the men looking up their dresses at their legs and underwear while they were kneeling and scrubbing the hallways and steps. I never understood how she or her mother knew that all the men would be in their apartments by then. Didn't any of them stay out later? It's hard to believe my grandmother would worry so much about this. At the time, my mother was only 8 or 9, and her sister Lucille was 6 or so. Their clothing was layered and lengthy, and undoubtedly could reveal nothing except in the mind of their mother. You'd need X-ray vision, or would have to stand directly underneath them, or perhaps turn them upside down to see anything. Nobody seemed to question the absurdity of this argument, as well as the visual impossibility of looking up the garments of totally covered young children. Besides, who other than some potential pedophile would even want to look? But mother had spoken, and the children complied. That was the way things went. Grumbling, questioning, or noncompliance were not options. The next one is about my father. And I'm a student at Columbia, and I came home from school, came home from the college, and this is what took place. When I arrived home that day at our house in Flushing, my father was in the living room, sitting in front of the black and white television set. I leaned over and kissed him, which I did right up until his death, and glanced over at the television screen. I noticed that it showed a pair of well-manicured hands along with the ends of his suit sleeves partially covering a French-cuffed shirt. I asked why the picture showed only the man's hands. My father told me those were the hands of Mr. Frank Costello, and Mr. Costello was testifying at a hearing before a U.S. Senate committee and didn't want to show his face. He was trying to remain unknown, unrecognizable. But as matters unfolded, that would turn out to be impossible. The hearings were part of an ongoing investigation into the depth and breadth of organized crime in interstate commerce. Costello was the head of one of the five New York mobs, and the government was trying to deport him to Italy, his birthplace. The lead senator was the Democrat Estes Kefauver from Tennessee, and the chief counsel was Rudolph Halley. When Costello answered their questions, his voice was hoarse and raspy. You could see the full faces and bodies of the committee members and the audience, but only Costello's hands. Costello sometimes refused to answer, citing his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Sometimes he would answer only by pausing to check with his attorney after the microphones in front of him were covered with his hands or the attorney's. Suddenly, my father blurted out, "Kefauver wants to be president, and Haley wants to be the mayor of New York." He then said angrily, "In the final analysis, they will get nothing, none of them." When I asked my father to explain this terribly unusual comment, he stared at me and said coldly, "My boy, you just don't get it. Powerful forces control whatever takes place in this country. It isn't the way you think. In order to run for office, you have to make deals, a lot of them. You need big backers who finance your campaign, and once they give you the money, you owe them, big time. The money was given in advance of favors that would be asked for and granted. Jobs and influences are controlled the same way. Judgeships are bought. The police are bought. When you want something done, you pay for it. Elected officials are bought every day. Powerful and inner circles controlling money orchestrate it all. If these people think they'll deport Mr. Costello, they're kidding themselves. It will never happen. He's too powerful and they all owe him. They know him and he knows them. And if they think they can convict him and put him in jail, that's even less possible. I was shocked. Here I was, deeply immersed in my freshman courses in contemporary civilization and the humanities. We were reading the works of great thinkers, studying Plato, Aristotle's Politics, Rousseau, Durkheim, John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, Edmund Burke, de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, along with many other great writers. My mind was being opened to all sorts of new ideas and perspectives. I had been in a different, totally new world at Columbia, an unknown and exciting territory. I was learning that any qualified citizen could run for and become the president or a mayor or anything else. And now my father was confronting me with his reality. How could he say those things? What did he know? How could he be so sure? His words overwhelmed me. This is how I found out my father was part of an illegal bookmaking syndicate. Once the state started its pari-mutuel gambling system and eliminated bookmaking at the tracks, the bookmakers did what they knew best and formed syndicates to take bets. In their thinking, what difference did it make where you bet? Under this well-controlled syndicate, my father sometimes ran bookmaking operations in his restaurants and diners that I mentioned earlier. Other times, he had a specific gambling territory, primarily in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and parts of Long Island City. This group had telephone lines and runners to carry bets and money between the bookmakers and their many customers. They also had public officials on their payrolls, especially local police officers and their supporters who would ignore what was going on. The cops gambled, too. Everybody justified their involvement in these betting operations, even though they were completely illegal. This was a pervasive, highly organized, corrupt gambling empire controlled by various families who also were engaged in many other activities, and my father was part of it. Incidentally, Costello never was deported and continued in his major illegal and legal enterprises. And then it goes on from there. I think I've given you enough of a taste of what life was in New York. Thank you.
I wish I had stopped every one of them. Those reticent, detached men who shuffled past me in the receiving line at my grandfather's funeral with a murmured, "Sorry for your loss," and an equally indifferent handshake. I barely knew these men who considered my grandfather's life and death significant enough to ascend out of the woodwork and afterwards descend. Other than an odd uncle or two, I never saw any of them again. It would have been a serious breach of etiquette at a Catholic funeral for a teenage girl to stop the line of mourners and say, "Wait, hold on. Who are you? Who were you to my grandfather? What can you tell me about his life before I was born?" I really wanted to know. Had they worked in the family grocery business alongside my grandfather when he was young? Had they been in his wedding in 1946 at this very same church, Our Lady of Lourdes in Waterbury, Connecticut? Had they seen my grandmother Carmela, resplendent in her wedding gown made from parachute silk, tiny ribbon roses embellishing each delicate sleeve? Or perhaps, most remarkably, had they too flown on a B-29 bomber during World War II? Had they too once worn the Army Air Guard uniform that was now being lowered 6 feet into the ground at Cavalry Cemetery, along with my grandfather's remains? I wish I'd had the courage to ask that day, but sadly, I allowed myself to be shuffled along with the rest of the torpid family members, moving through the relatively meaningless service in a gray-faced haze. The only difference between this particular ceremony and the slew of other Catholic funerals I'd been dragged to was that Grandpa was buried with military honors. This meant that two frankly terrified-looking young soldiers fired off three rounds, shakily made their way through taps on the bugle, then folded the flag from the casket into a triangle very, very carefully before handing it to my aunt. I found out later from my uncle, who'd been a captain in the Air Force, that the American flag is supposed to be folded exactly 13 times for the 13 original U.S. colonies, and that you mustn't have any stripes showing, only stars. To me, the expression on those young boys' faces mirrored my own whenever I had to make a bed with my very, very precise grandmother. I could read the message in their disquieted eyes. Don't screw it up, don't screw it up, don't screw it up, don't screw it up. Perhaps the fleeting desire that came upon me that day to have a meaningful human interaction with someone who had once known my grandfather was simply an echo of my own, yet as yet unacknowledged desire to actually know my grandfather myself. The truth was that nobody really knew anyone in my family of origin. Really knowing people requires a certain level of intimacy. Into me, you see, as a therapist of mine, was a little too fond of wordplay, once pointed out. I never really saw my grandfather, not until they were lowering him into the earth. After he died, a weathered photo album was excavated from the overcluttered house on Melrose Avenue among the obituary clippings, prayer cards, and antiquated statues of the infant Jesus of Prague. Inside were pictures of a handsome young man I had never met, posing with his arm draped lazily over the propeller of a B-29, collar askew, legs casually crossed, looking for all the world like James Dean 10 years before Rebel Without a Cause was born. Who is this suave, cool guy? And where was he? There were pictures of Grandpa and his army buddies holding spears, axes, other indigenous weapons, and what looked very much like human skulls. I asked my dad about it later, and he told me that Grandpa had been in India, in the Philippines, and all over the Pacific Theater. In fact, he had been awarded a special ribbon for it. The furthest I had known my grandfather to have gone was to New Haven, and that was just because the pizza there was better than the pizza in Waterbury. The only conversation I remember having with my grandfather that did not revolve around patriotism, skim milk, or the Catholic Church was the time he told me, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." I'm sure he repeated it because it sounded like something a grandfather should say, and I'm equally sure that he was unaware of its actual origin, spoken by Polonius in Hamlet, who is not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed. I'm just glad that despite the fact that I was a snarky and sarcastic teenager at the time, and in fact I had just seen a fabulous modern production of Hamlet in which Hamlet puts his headphones on every time Polonius starts talking. Nevertheless, out of respect, my only reply was, "Thanks, Grandpa." The elderly priest at the funeral had informed us that my grandfather had been baptized, married, and buried in the same church. Did that kind of thing even happen anymore? What I didn't realize until years later, as an adult, what I was craving that day, not just from my grandfather, but from anyone and everyone, was a true connection with another human being. Actual warmth, empathy, compassion, responsiveness. Into me, you see. That day at Our Lady of Lourdes was the last time I ever received Holy Communion in the Catholic Church. But actual communion, a meeting of souls, true understanding on a deep level, did not happen that day, nor did it happen for many years. Today I have one living grandmother at Brooksby Village in Danvers. She's 99, and she's fond of saying, "I live this long out of spite." I feel guilty for not calling. I know she's not doing well, and I know my mother is not the best of caretakers. The family is enmeshed and dysfunctional. The less contact with them I have, the better for my own emotional health. And yet, the ghost of my teenage self, full of unasked and unanswered questions, is looking at me with disquieted eyes. Don't screw it up.
Wonderful, what a great reading, what a great evening, and there are great baked goods provided by the readers.